Podcasting from a secret location deep inside the political colossus. This is Radio Free GOP, the voice of the Republican resistance.
Part of the beauty of me is that I'm very rich. Let me tell you, I'm a really smart guy.
What's your name again?
John Miller.
Yes, that's correct.
Oh my God, they've got a madman on their hands.
We will have no truth nor parley with you or the grisly gang who work your wicked will. You do your worst, and we will do our best.
We've come to a turning point, a moment for hard decisions. If not us, who? And if not now, when?
It's 11:59 at Radio Free America, and this is Uncle Sam with music and the truth until dawn. Right now, I got a few words for some of our brothers and sisters in the occupied zone. The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall.
This is Radio Free GOP with your host, Mike Murphy.
The super mega ultra what the hell just happened debate. We're going to break that down with my friend Mark Leibovitz, ace magazine writer from the New York Times, author of the classic Our Town, all here on Radio Free GOP.
He used to have a big career, but now he's had enough. Podcasting's like therapy. His shrink says it's great stuff. Radio Free GOP.
Okay, it is over. It is the morning after the debate. I'm here in our undisclosed location in New York City. Cable TV is chattering away as it does, trying to interpret this. I was part of that this morning on Morning Joe. And so let me give you my take on what happened. What a night. I don't think we've ever had one of these where a presidential candidate in a general election in a massively televised debate said, "They love me." So Trump at least dented the history books here. Now, what's the headline? I would say this. Trump needs a new logo for his campaign, a picture of Trump's face with a huge fishhook in it, because I've never seen anybody take the bait like he did last night. For that reason, she did win the debate. Is the campaign over? No. There's a lot of energy left to be expended. We have October. Beware the presidents of September, be they in polling data that goes up and down or in media hysteria. But the problem Trump had last night was he's a one-trick pony who ran out of tricks. Now, the first 20-25 minutes, he was pretty strong. Why? Because he kept going back to his great monkey trick, which is you politicians have had your chance and you have screwed everything up. I'm an anti-politician in a change election. Why not try me? That throw-them-all-out change mentality is the mainspring of the electorate right now. And Trump, with all his flaws, does have appeal there. Hillary, on the other hand, is the perfect foil for him because she's nothing but politics. She has a career in it. She's been around as a pre-aware political title since the late 70s. Also, she has the bad habit, particularly this year, of speaking in those poll-tested bromides that they can't seem to resist, and the people have heard so much they're sick of them. So for the first 25 minutes or so, when Trump was taking every single question back to, you've had your 30 years, you're part of politics, it hasn't worked, try something new, he was selling tickets, he was scoring some points. But then she did what is, you know, the easiest thing in the world to do, and it was predictable. She started pushing Trump's buttons, talked about the inherited money from dad, talked about quite well how the tax returns that you cannot get out of Donald Trump with the jaws of life machine are clearly hiding something. Trump took the bait and he ran with it for the rest of the debate. It got worse because Trump started losing energy. Hillary is no prize winner in the charisma department, but she did what she had to do. She was unflappable and even presidential in the face of Trump's endless bullying and, frankly, often rude antics. That was the hurdle she had to cross, and she crossed it. So that was the contrast America saw. Somebody ready for prime time, even if you, like me, don't like a lot of her ideas, versus somebody, as the clock wore on, who was clearly not up to the job as president. When the debate finally lurched into foreign policy stuff near the end, Trump was on planet non sequitur. He had landed his spaceship there quite firmly. He was literally sounding like somebody on the back of a bus. He was not making much sense. That hurt him a lot. He's never looked more out of depth than he did in the last 30 minutes of the debate last night. In fact, Trump, the tough guy, the strong man, running out of energy and becoming so, well, let's say it, weak. That was quite a moment in this campaign. I'd even say he was low energy. So what does it mean? It means today is going to be fascinating, the day after the debate. Trump is going to have to deal with the fact that he, today, is America's biggest loser. And that'll be hard for the orange menace to swallow. He's built his whole faux brand on the idea of being America's biggest winner. But the referees, the scorecard, even those in the elite media who I know are discounted by many voters, it's almost unanimous that Trump, the great winner, lost. The orange menace is not going to take that well. God, I would pay cash money to be a fly on the wall in Trump land right now, listening to him rant and rave. The good news is everybody can be a fly on the wall in Trump land because Trump is transparent. He will vent his mind and his spleen today at a rally on the space coast of Florida in Melbourne. You can guarantee if he doesn't tweet up a storm between now and then or do some more television appearances, he is going to go to that rally with an adoring throng of primary voters, and he is going to unscrew his head, and we're going to know everything he's thinking about. He's going to review the debate. We're going to hear more of this ludicrous thing about the microphones not working. You know, I heard every word, so I don't know. Maybe the microphones were switching the language or something. But we're going to hear about the mind control plot. We're going to hear about that. He'll flail at Hillary. There could be a Trump, more or less, breakdown later today, and it will be, if anything else, amusing. So what's the bottom line on the race? I believed, as all of you listeners have heard, that Trump is in a demographic cul-de-sac, and he's stuck there. I thought he was going to lose before the debate, and I think he's going to lose now. Trump, more than Hillary, needs to change people's perceptions about him. She's got problems. It would do her a lot of good to move some votes from undecided to her because people have doubts about her in this non-politician year. But Trump is in the chokehold. There just aren't enough high school-educated white guys and white women to elect a president anymore. Trump has to move the needle with one of two groups. You've heard this from me before, but it remains true with the hard reality of arithmetic. Number one, he's got to get minorities to change their opinion about him. That is very hard to do for a Republican generically, let alone Trump, who's calibrated his campaign often to code words of race. I don't think he'll pull that off. So 30% of the vote is going to be hostile to him. He'll lose him by probably more than 60 points. That's all minority vote. So the big enchilada, the group that decides this election, are college-educated white people, particularly college-educated white women. Romney carrying them? Trump is not. He is losing the women. He's slightly carrying the men. He is way underperforming. So what this debate should have been about was Trump dramatically changing the opinion of that group, and it just did not happen. I don't think Trump lost too many votes last night. His crowd will like what he said. He hit that chord of anger about economic stagnation, anger about trade, and anger at politics. But he didn't grow. He didn't change the opinion of those college-educated white women with a performance that was both boorish and woefully ill-informed. So nothing happened that would move Trump forward, and some things happened that'll move him back at least a little with the kind of swing voters he needs to attract. All in all, bad night for Donald. Now we get to have another debate, so we'll see. There are going to be two more, and this saga will continue. The media business, of course, has an interest in making every day the most important day of the campaign. So all that stuff you heard about this being the most important debate in the history of the planet will now be sidelined for the new most important debate in the history of the planet, the next one in St. Louis. So we're going to be kind of caught in that Groundhog Day. But the fundamentals of the race are bad for Trump to begin with, and they got worse after such a clumsy, unprepared debate performance. When in doubt, there's a moral to the story. Prepare, do your homework, rehearse, have discipline. Politics is a discipline game, and that's one thing that Donald Trump just doesn't have. We got some good stuff coming up. We're going to talk to Mark Leibovich, who has one of the sharpest eyes for detail in politics, writes for the New York Times Magazine. You probably know his book, This Town. And we're going to unveil our new hit T-shirt, The Orange Menace. It's all coming up right here on Radio Free GOP. Now, let's pay some bills. Mike Murphy, podcasting sanity, Radio Free GOP. Let me tell you something you already know. Good ingredients are the key to good food, and that's what I like about Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference, so it's important to know where your food comes from. Now, for less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make those delicious home-cooked meals. Now, the pre-portioned part is really important because that makes the cooking easier if you have my level of cooking skills, which are not too impressive. But I did it, and I'll have to tell you, the food was delicious, and it all came together in less than 40 minutes. Now, whether it's Japanese ramen noodles or wild-caught Alaska salmon or heirloom tomatoes, the food you get from Blue Apron is the best. They've got a network of suppliers, artisanal farms, family-run in the most part, fisheries, ranchers. They draw their food from the best places, and you can taste the difference. They're also fiends for variety. That's important. They create new recipes every week, and they don't repeat them within a year. So you're always going to have interesting new seasonal recipes and ingredients, which gives you some variety. Now, the other cool part is you get the recipe cards, which are very easy to follow, and you get to keep them. So if you have a dish you really like, you can cook it again as many times as you want because you have the instructions and you can just go out and procure the food yourself and cook it because you already have and you know how to do it and you know you really liked it. It's also very flexible. Blue Apron lets you customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. You choose delivery options to fit your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. And again, it's easy. You follow those instructions in under 40 minutes, you're going to have a delicious home-cooked meal from the best ingredients. I am convinced you're going to like it as much as I did, so we have a great offer for you. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/RFGOP for Radio Free GOP. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so give it a try. Go on the website today and see what those menus are and see if you like it as much as I do. Now, one more time, that's blueapron.com/RFGOP. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. I also want to give a shout out to my pals at Ricochet.com, the smartest and most civil center-right community on the web. No trolls, they guarantee it. You become a member, you let your voice be heard and listen to great podcasts. They put out about 9 or 10. They're all good. It's all yours for just $5 a month. And Radio Free GOP listeners get their first month free. So go to Ricochet.com/join. That's Ricochet.com/join and sign up today. You will enjoy it. Now, let's talk t-shirts. What can I tell you? We bowed to popular demand. A little moniker I came up with, the Orange Menace, has caught on, and we've gotten some emails saying, wouldn't that make a great t-shirt? Well, we said yes. So we hooked up with a great artist, and now on RadioFreeGOP.com, it has arrived. The Orange Menace t-shirt in screaming black and orange. Perfect Halloween wear to scare the neighborhood. Perfect to irritate the Trumpkin in your life. Perfect to keep as a souvenir of this crazy election. Check it out. If you like it, it can be yours. You just have to go on RadioFreeGOP.com and be one of the first to wear the colors of the Republican resistance with your own Orange Menace t-shirt. I know I'm going to be wearing mine just to irritate people. I'll blast it out on Twitter too, and that'll get them going. We also have other things you can do on the website. We have our Amazon button. You click that, and the next time you buy something on Amazon, and I recommend something massively expensive, a little tiny bit falls off the truck, so to speak, and we get, in the parlance of politics, our beak wet. Helps pay the overhead around here, as does the PayPal button, where you can give 99 cents or $9.95 or $4 or whatever you want to help defray the cost here at the podcast. A Republican resistance requires minimal support, but every penny counts. Thank you for your support. Thank you for the great reviews on iTunes and everything you're doing to make this podcast a success. We are now, I am told, right up about in the 1% group of most listened to podcasts. I really appreciate that, and thank you for the support you've given us in our work here to take the reality of the campaign to you with honest analysis and take a stand on Trump. Now, let's get back to the show.
Resistance Podcasting Radio Free GOP.
I was on Meet the Press last weekend, and nothing brings them out of the Twitter woodwork like that. We have a few angry tweets. All right, first up is Educated Patriot. Why do they always call themselves patriots? I think that's something you prove rather than self-declare. But anyway, at Murphy Mike, you are a, all caps, bald-headed, jealous loser, period. See why Jeb lost so badly. Only person in a cage is your ugly ass. And then two little icons of bowling ball bombs. Yes, a highly, highly educated patriot there. Mark Davis, at Mark Dav, and a bunch of numbers, says, at Murphy Mike, you are a traitor, T-R-A-D-E-R, to the only hope for our great nation. Grow a pair. All right, Mark, we'll put that one down in the undecided file. And then finally, Nivco, at Nicolo 007, a man of action, just like Bond, really. All the ladies agree. Nivco writes, poor performance on MTP, comma, out of all the true R, letter R, strategist, why the hell, small h, are you on? Well, payola, Nivco, it's all fixed. Just like you always suspected, the voice in your head is right. There is a conspiracy and we're all robots. Okay, that's it. That's this week's edition of Angry Tweets.
Angry Tweets on Radio Free GOP.
Our guest this week is my old friend Mark Leibovich. He is an excellent profile writer. He's got a great style, and he's famous for getting insightful, clever profiles of major figures in politics, not to mention his book, This Town, which was a perfect, perfect examination of the weird, freaky culture of the slippery pole known as Washington, D.C. He is an acute observer of such things for the New York Times, and I could think of nobody better to have a conversation with. So, from our secret location in New York City, right after the debate, here is my conversation with Mark Leibovich.
It's time to ask some questions and go behind the scenes. Here's our latest interview. We'll try to keep it clean. Radio Free GOP.
We are here in our hiding in plain sight, undisclosed location, very early on a rainy Manhattan morning after the great, amazing, could there be more breathless hype debate. I'm here with the one and only journalist, storyteller, bon vivant, man of many talents, Mark Leibovich. Mark, thanks for doing Radio Free GOP.
Mike, it's a pleasure and an honor. Great to be up at this hour. Wait a minute. This doesn't have a specific time. Podcasts can be listened to at any moment.
Yeah,
right?
Why are we doing this so early? Well, because the Orthodoxy Police sleeps in, and this was our moment. Now, we apologize. There's a little audio background noise. We're at one of the, and I have to say, for the New York Times being well-funded by Mr. Carlos Slim, one of the shittier hotels in New York City, where you're clearly staying. Set the scene for me with those amazing powers of observation you're so well known for.
Well, start with the 2 hours of sleep that both I think you got and I got too. It was, first of all, getting from Hofstra University, which is somewhere in the middle of Long Island, back here at an ungodly hour was hard enough. But we're in like Times Square, which itself is an abomination. It's not a bad hotel, Mike. We have this weird Euro music playing and like we're overlooking, here are my powers of observation, weird Euro music playing. Yeah. We got Drizzle, we got a little Dom DeLillo view out the window, literary reference there.
You know, we can actually, though, if we brought the binocs, it's early, so early that the full sun isn't up and we can see the yellow light coming out of one of these old buildings and we can look into about 100 windows, rear window style. Nothing seems to be going on, but it's a great New York.
Check out that, like over there, like the fifth story over there. See the one where the that one. Okay.
Oh yeah, exactly. Is that Trump in a bunny suit?
No, I think it is. Actually.
My old eyes fail me. Well, before we get to the scene setting at Hofstra, because I want to know what it was like to actually be there. I was at the NBC broadcast tower last night. Let me ask you the question we always start the podcast with: how did you get into this?
I fell into it. I needed a job. I was 23, 24 years old. I saw an ad in the Boston Phoenix, which is the old weekly newspaper, which I'm sure the Murphy family was reading.
I remember it from doing political work up there.
Political work.
As alternative newspapers go, it was kind of the accomplished one. I mean, it had a real staff, and it did real stuff.
I was part of that real staff.
Finest head shop ads in the world in the back. I mean, it was the leading alternative paper.
It was a classic paper publication that was ruined by the internet. I mean, a lot of online porn, a lot of classified ads, that kind of thing. In fact, the first politician I ever profiled was William Weld, who had just won the gubernatorial election. Did you work for him?
I did not. I worked for Mitt Romney up there.
I did that governor's
race. But yeah, and Weld is now the esteemed vice presidential candidate on the librarian ticket.
The future vice president of the United States. Although I heard, weren't there some rumblings that he might drop out? There was
a rumor that he was going to say enough of this and come out and just endorse Hillary, which he might still do.
It would be a classic Weld thing to do. Yeah, just that's sort of why like, I'm a little bored by this. Let's try something else. Yeah. So anyway, I did that.
Let me just interject for a minute.
Sure.
If Weld were the Libertarian candidate for president, I think the media would be giving him a ride now because he's interesting. And I think if he got the ride, it would catch on more than Gary Johnson.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think he might have been at the debate threshold, and he'd have been a lot of fun at the debate.
Yeah, he would have been great at it.
But the last night's debate was plenty fun. But anyway, so I needed a job. It was 23. I was 23. I sort of was doing this for a while. It was a real job. Wasn't making real money, but it was a job. And then a couple of years later, I said, hey, I kind of do this for a living. And eventually other places started hiring me, and here I am.
No, that's good. And so here is the New York Times. And what was like your assignment last night? Like, go to Hofstra and find the essential truth, win us a Pulitzer, and we're still going to put you at the Big Chain Hotel.
Yeah, all that's happening, right? What's happening as
living
we speak.
The dream.
You know, it's funny. I'm actually working on a longer-term project on, should I say this? Hillary Clinton. I'm working on a bigger Clinton story for the magazine. I'm a magazine writer, so I just sort of step back and pick my spots. I'll probably write something this morning on the aftermath of the debate, which was this odd scene. I mean, the whole Hofstra scene was just shell shock. Everyone's kind of got there, and no one knew, one, what to expect, what we were doing there, what it was going to look like, what it was going to feel like. And there was this eerie quiet throughout the whole evening, as if everyone, first of all, in the media room where I was sort of anticipating how they were going to blow this and how they were going to miss just whatever the essential story is as we have the entire race. And it just was weird seeing them on stage. And then I don't know if it was picked up on the feed that left the building, but you could hear her saying into a microphone as she was meeting him, "Hiya, Donald," or something like that. And it was like such a random thing to say, and it was kind of sarcastic.
But they all do that. Well, you lock eyes and do the false hello, which translates basically into fuck you, said without those words.
Well, actually, is there any kind of strategery that goes into that? I mean, don't people sometimes like fuck with the other candidate by like whispering something?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that. Sometimes it can go very childish very quickly. What you really want is your candidate to walk in there feeling 10 feet tall.
Right.
You know, just feeling like ready to throw lightning bolts, large and in charge. What's that other clown doing here? And totally prepared at anything they're going to hear from the other candidate they've heard before and they're confident they can handle. Right. Well, let me ask you some more scene setting questions.
Sure. Yeah.
Last night, I saw an endless parade of Hofstra functionaries explaining how great they are at doing this. And every media person I was texting back and forth with was screaming in pain. And I know a pundit who was like, you know, going berserk on the logistics. So what was it like? If just do the word picture for us if one of our listeners had to show up and cover this thing.
Kind of whiny, bitchy, first world problem media alert to come, right?
Right.
It was a bit of a rough setup. First of all, Hofstra University is about, I guess from LaGuardia, where I flew into, maybe about an hour. The traffic made it about an hour and a half. Road closures made it about maybe 2 hours. Lousy cab driver made it about 2:15. You had a big sort of logistical challenge just to get in. You then had a couple of lines. It's long walking, parking lot shuttles. So there was a lot of that. There was more than you would find. I mean, the Cleveland Convention, everyone was predicting utter and absolute chaos. It actually turned out not to be that bad. I mean,
perimeter. No, I thought logistically they could, except for that alley where all the bars were.
Could walk through it.
Crazy person could walk through and shoot me in the back of the head. So,
correct.
Of course, I was focused on that being incredibly self
or worse, obsessed. Ask you to go on TV.
Yeah, which was more painful,
yeah,
I can tell
exactly.
You. So where did they put you on, a gym or something?
They put us in a pretty enormous gym. The other thing is you showed up, and usually when you register for a debate, your media organization, you know, you just sign up and you go out there and you get your desk and you get your little outlet and you get your wireless code and you start. Here there was a couple of tiers where you had to wait in a couple of lines to get your wireless, to make sure your seat was there, and maybe this is the New York Times, maybe whoever did this like screwed up, so I probably shouldn't complain too much, but there was a lot of stuff that had to go on before you got settled. There also was kind of, the spin room wasn't well delineated from the media filing center, so you had Mike Pence, for instance, walking through on his way to the Fox hovel, and like, I mean, like, for some reason, like, there was like this Fox, not hospitality suite, but whatever their set was, these Trump people just kept walking in and out. Like that was like their kind of satellite office.
Safe space.
It was their safe space, exactly. Right. And then you had about 700 foreign reporters gathered around them invading their safe space. But so you would periodically be sitting down and then there'd be swarms around.
I interrupt you for 1 sec.
Sure.
Why does every foreign editor everywhere think they have to send their folks
there?
To the location?
You know, it's my. I will let you in on a little secret. The New York Times, which is in the state of New York, probably about an hour and a half from Hofstra, I would say we probably had about 20 people covering the debate. Maybe 18 were still. Actually, no, it's probably 15 were at the Times newsroom and didn't. And actually saved themselves a lot of time not going.
Well, the truth is, when I did campaigns for a living, I mean, I'd have to be there, and we're talking about how that all works, but I would always want to quietly watch it on television like voters do, rather than this insanity of the huge media filing center and then the kabuki theater of the spin room, where frankly the reporters hate the spin room. It has no impact. It just gets in the way.
Wait, you mean regular voters don't actually sit in a large media filing center and read each other on Twitter? I was shocked. No, I mean, I will say, though, that yes, there are a lot of foreign reporters at these things. In fairness, this is their only shot to get within 30 feet of deputy assistant media advisor Joe Blow, who actually might give him the time of day. Or if you're Joe Japanese reporter from, you know, in from Tokyo, I don't know if they would call themselves Joe Japanese reporter, but for my purposes, you know, you can actually yell across to Donald Trump, who himself walks into the spin room after the debate and says, "Mr. Trump, blah, blah, blah." And he quite often will answer it. So it's a bizarre
thing. I heard him say, "Get lost, Tojo," which probably made somebody's career.
Maybe it did. He would have made my career if he said that to me. But anyway, it was an odd scene, though. And we watched the debate, and you know, then we just sort of tried to figure out what we saw. But the
are there cat calls? You're all communists, you're all for Hillary. Were people like booing and groaning and stuff, or was it people are working so they don't time for that?
Oh, we were working very, very hard. We were tweeting at each other. I didn't hear any cat calls from where we were sitting, because we're all the consummate professionals. I mean, so yeah, no, I didn't hear any.
In the old days, there'd be liquor, which made it a lot more fun. Now the press corps is a lot drier, at least during debates, than it used to be.
I don't know, man. Some of this wheatgrass, you know, juice that they were selling were pretty, pretty hard. No, it was pretty subdued as it went. I mean, I do think, look, I mean, not to make too much of this, but it was a very, very, it was a tense environment because no one knew what to expect. I mean, you kind of knew what you were going to get with Obama v. Romney, or, I mean, maybe even McCain versus Obama. I mean, you know, you have people who are, you know, far more predictable and who are going to be more prepared. And so
with Trump, the big question is always, how long will it take for the meds to wear off? Because you knew he was going to open with
about
sedated,
a half hour last night, right?
Yeah, it was. That was right about the Vegas under, too, because it was clear that they were going to the extent he even does prep. You know, Trump prep is not really prep.
Right.
It was going to be, don't be crazy. That was, you know, be reasoned. And I tweeted this and, of course, caught complete Twitter hell for it. But for the first 20 minutes or so, I thought he did a pretty good job of constantly coming back to the fact that you've been part of the problem for 30 years, your politics, because he knows that's the mainspring of the election is fire all these clowns. And I was kind of working for him. She did not have an answer to that,
which
surprised me.
No.
Because that was the most obvious single thing that was coming.
Right.
But then she did, you know, she started going into the psychological jujitsu with the Fred Trump line and a few of those things. And predictably, she got way under his skin. And then Trump broke out of the, you know, the Halcyon cage. And there he went.
And it was so easy to do.
Yes.
I mean, really, it was just one line. And I agree with you. I thought he had a very strong, you know, start. And I thought the I'm change, you are part of the problem thing, he could have hit that like for 90 whole minutes. It would have been repetitive, but it would have actually just worked, because I don't think she had anything resembling an answer. But then it just became apparent that once she sort of survived that initial, I wouldn't even call it a flurry, but that initial maybe surprise of seeing him really kind of, you know, inhabiting his reality a little bit, she could just sort of prick at it like pretty steadily. And by 45 minutes in, I think the whole dynamic was both changed and then set for the rest of the way.
When could you feel in the room, even silently, just the energy of the zillion reporters watching every word and the sound of the keys typing?
I'm an expert at feeling energy, Mike.
Yeah, well, when you were channeling the energy of the room, When did you start to feel that, you know what it's like, that kind of tension move through of just excitement of a story when you saw kind of the Trump ocean liner start the Poseidon adventure over sideways?
Well, there was a point, I'd say about maybe 40 minutes in, where he just kind of blew three questions in a row over maybe a 20-minute period. The tax return question, I thought it was just a disaster for him.
And she had her shtick down.
She had her shtick down perfectly. I think he's hiding something. He could be not as rich
and
as
she had the list of what
she
he,
had the list. She got a three. Yeah, exactly. that was good for her. You know, as soon as Lester Holt went to the birther question, you could just see the disaster sort of roiling for him, because I don't think he handled that particularly well. And she had a pretty good speech there.
Oh, yeah, he dug in.
He dug in. Yeah. I mean, she said, you know, African-American president. I think she could have gone even harder at that, although I don't think she needed to put too fine a point on it. He didn't have an answer for that. And then there was a third where I think it was a temperament question, where it was a classic tell, don't show thing where I just have a good temperament. It's the best thing about me. And
he tried to kind of get on offense by saying, and she crazy as a loon. We all know it.
Right.
And it was just so forced.
It was forced.
You could tell he knew he was losing. And that was the skeleton key that broke the sedated Trump lock. And he started flailing.
Completely agree. Yeah. And I think that what's interesting about debates is, I mean, you think these are two such seasoned performers, and they clearly are, but you can see how confidence works in these things. Like,
totally.
You could tell it took her maybe a good half hour to really get her confidence going and to sort of get used to the sound of her voice up there and just the whole scene up there. And then as soon as he started tripping a little bit, you could just see that he was kind of losing his. And it is amazing. I mean, you said, you know, the key is to make your candidate feel 10 feet tall. Yeah. It is amazing how precarious that is in a setting like that.
Well, there's a weird kind of jungle thing that goes on, particularly in a two-way debate like this. These are different than the primary debates. The primary debate, they're all up there. And, you know, you never know when somebody's going to try to do a magic trick, because they're all desperate to, like, have the moment. When this, you're just stuck in the stainless steel death cage for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And you are very focused on the other person. And when they start to lose it, you feel that. And some weird anthropological gene kicks in of like, ah, I smell blood. And instantly you get that energy hit. And so she was smart that when she kind of had him on the run a bit, she turned up the heat. I thought her answer on the birther thing, which I'm sure they knew would be a weak spot for him because he's crazy about it, was very good, because it was shameless, but she turned some lunacy on birtherism into an assault that was so vile and so un-American, it almost made the first African-American president cry. I mean, when she painted that picture of Obama, I thought she was going to go, you had to sit down with his daughters and explain that daddy is an American.
And Mr. Trump, I wasn't born in Kenya either. I don't look like Ronald Reagan.
So it was so shameless, but they got away from it because he just has a big button on his head. You push it, and he'll go do something stupid on the birther thing, and that's what we saw.
I was shocked that he didn't have a better answer. I mean, look, I mean, he could have won a lot of points by just not apologizing, but say, look, I regret it. I shouldn't have done it, and just moved on, like she did with the emails. I think it was kind of almost ironic that as soon as he started going off on stamina, he clearly was losing his. I mean, I think it was at a moment when he was betraying a clear loss of, like, stamina. You could just sort of feel the needle sort of being pulled out of the football.
Totally. I mean, I actually thought, wait for it, he was very low energy, Mark. I've been waiting a year to say that.
Oh, you must feel great now, right?
On a cheap personal level.
I hope Governor Bush is listening to this.
Well,
I really do. Does Governor Bush listen to this?
Oh, yeah.
Are you allowed to communicate with him now that the super PAC is over?
Yes, so the Iron Curtain has been lifted.
It's been lifted.
So everything's legit,
But he'll listen to the podcast, right?
Yeah, he has been known to tune in, like many leading Americans. It's interesting, the weird hodgepodge of people who listen to Radio Free GOP, but, you know, the Republican resistance is growing every day.
And they're all Murphy clients.
I wish. Yeah. So he... If it had been Jeb last night, it would have been a debate with Hillary Clinton on the defense. But, you know, again, Trump is always going to be the Velcro of the election, and that you saw that. And I've been saying that he's such a one-trick pony that 90-minute debates are not his friend, because the act wears thin and he doesn't have anything else.
Right.
Though I will say, here's one point. I was watching all the media. I was part of it for a while on NBC last night, and everybody, at least on our network, was kind of banging the disaster for Trump horn, and I was doing some of that, but
don't know if I buy that.
Yeah, here's what you got to remember: when Trump does the one trick, as limited as it is in terms of sustaining an entire debate,
he doesn't lose
the
anyone.
Trick is pretty powerful, because the trick is fire all these idiots in politics, and that is the mainspring of this election. It is the most powerful force in the electorate. It props Trump up, so even when he makes all these terrible mistakes, you know, it's like a super steroid injection. You can't underestimate the power of that core message. And I was, again, I said this earlier, but I was surprised she had no answer for it. That's the one thing she should have been prepped.
Right.
I thought she'd say something like, let me tell you, the best part of experience is you make mistakes and you learn from them. You can see where the political system doesn't work. You can be part of bad things and know how to blah, 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 right. repair them. I think Trump didn't lose any of his core support last night, but his core support is not enough to win.
He needs to grow.
Yeah, he's the one who needs to get a big hunk of the electorate to change their mind about him. And last night, I think he didn't get that at all.
Yeah, I thought she actually missed an opportunity. I mean, I agree. She had no answer for the 30 years and nothing has happened thing. But he turned those claims into absurdities at certain points. Like when he said, you've spent your entire adult life helping ISIS.
Yeah.
And she could have said, well, you know, so when ISIS was founded in Wellesley, Massachusetts in 1968, right. I was a mere college junior. I mean, you know.
The infiltration ISIS began with the lacrosse team.
Exactly. The field hockey team. They didn't have lacrosse back then. You know, ISIS started in 2013. She left state like in early 2013. I mean, you know, if you want to play that game, she could have played that game. All of this being said, I don't think she had a great night. I thought she wasn't at her sharpest. I've seen her debate better.
I gave her an A-, but on her curve. And the main reason I did was I thought she was strategic in the debate and he wasn't. She was unflappable to his antics, which was the thing the media was ready to kill her with, which is, oh, she got on the defensive, rattled, blah, blah, blah. And she went into her own kind of zone that, well, not the most appealing thing in the world. She's still Hillary Clinton, kind of the candidate dog food that dogs don't love.
Right.
She, compared to Trump, clearly passed the cool-headed. She handled him, which was what she had to do. So that's hard because you got essentially a lunatic next to you unscrewing his head. And she handled that, so that earned an A- for me, but it was an A-.
I would say on her curve, I'd probably give her a B+. So I've seen her debate a lot better. On the curve next to Trump, I'd give her a solid A-. Yeah, maybe an A-, A.
What do you think is going on? I mean, you've spent some time with Trump. You've done profiles.
Sure, I've spent a fair amount of time with both of them.
What do you think is going on?
I'm dear friends with both of them. I've known them both for years.
Right. Well, you're all in this town together.
Yes,
we'll get to that in a minute.
We're all such good friends.
What do you think Trump land is like now? I picture a lot of you knuckleheads, you and your coaching. What would it be like a fly on the wall this morning? Is he silently pounds to the meatloaf or whatever is... Because he knows. You could read it all over him.
You could
tell
as soon as he was walking off the stage. I mean, first of all, he didn't even bother. Like he did a kind of cursory thanking of Lester Holt. But you could tell he kind of wanted to leave. Bill and Hillary kind of had the stage to themselves. You know, I don't think Trump land this morning is any different from how he usually is, which is basically just Trump dining alone on meatloaf, watching the shows, right?
Right. Can you imagine what that was like for him sitting last night? You know he watched everything.
Well, it was funny because he came into the spin room probably within 5 minutes of leaving the stage. So all of a sudden he comes in and he kind of walked almost parade-like through the thing. And
with the weird Trump entourage.
It's his family. It's his family. It's Kellyanne Conway. It's who's like on TV to our left as we speak. The Breitbart guy, what's his name? Steve Bannon. He was there and a couple of other people.
Belted by gamma rays. My joke is, looks like he's been belted by Glenn Livett.
I think there was a little of that.
Last night, for sure. I don't blame him.
Well, yes.
I'd buy. Steve, I'll send you a bottle.
But so he was, he walked into the spin room, and within 5 minutes of leaving the stage, he was like, I've won every online poll, which means that he probably went on to Drudge.
Breitbart News.
And it was like under Breitbart or Drudge, and it had like 10 million to 2 or something like that. So I think he probably stayed up all night watching stuff, watching the shows he never watches.
I think he was supposed to go to a victory party of sorts.
He blew it off. I mean, in fairness to him, I think he wanted to get the hell out of Hofstra, which, and if I had his car and entourage, helicopter, whatever, I'd have been right on there.
Right.
And I also would have more to tell you about what his headspace was like today.
So you spent, as we said, a lot of time with him. I think today's quandary for him will be, he's going to watch all this cable process news, which is a bubble and a little bit overrated. But the headline is going to be Trump lost to Hillary. And he's the world's greatest winner. So now he's America's biggest loser, at least for a day. That's going to be interesting. And they're going to have to do something to change the channel really quickly. I wonder how he'll take that. What's your guess?
Well, it's interesting. I think the key word there is for a day. I don't think this election, even for a big debate like this, there has been any precedent for there being staying power or like things like this lasting more than a few days. I mean, I do think if you want to take an argument from last night that is good for Trump, some of the reviews have this sort of David Cameron won the Brexit, the Remain debates also, right? I mean, you have a whole bunch of elites howling like me and you.
No. You're totally right.
There is some of that. And I think in 2 days from now, when everyone's fixated on whatever thing that little cliffhangery thing that he was throwing out there about the Clinton family, that thing at the end.
Yeah, I brought my dynamite and I didn't use it, but stay tuned.
That was bizarre. I actually thought, as he was beginning that sentence, I thought, okay, here is when kind of a bad performance becomes self-immolation, because if he had brought up Monica or Jennifer Flowers or something, it would have been just...
Well, there's another debate. Two more are coming.
Oh, I'm sure it'll come up. I mean, he sat actually in the spin room. He said, well, I decided, Chelsea Clinton was there and she was a fine young woman and I didn't want to say anything with her.
He's always the hero of every story.
He is the hero of every
story. Well, I was going to do it, but then I looked and I saw that fine young woman and I thought, I owe America the right... it's always... he's a hero.
Children were coming up to thank him for putting the birth certificate matter to bed last night. I mean, that was I can't... Because, that was a raging debate. I mean, they couldn't talk about anything else on the shows for
America
years.
Was paralyzed with questions.
Paralyzed with questions.
He broke the log
Correct.
Jam.
Oh, thank you.
What?
Thank you, Mr. Trump.
What was his body chemistry like last night in the spin room? I was sitting at 30 Rock in a glass box waiting for somebody else to wrap up and get my damn television time. So I couldn't see it.
Yeah, his body, it was, look, he can move through a crowd. It was red carpety. I mean, there was probably this corridor maybe 5 feet across opened up. He's sort of moving through it. He takes his question from Bloomberg here. He takes his question, not Michael Bloomberg, but Bloomberg Newsroom, takes a question from someone on NBC he might recognize, someone on CNN he might recognize, all the networks he doesn't watch, someone from Fox, of course, Hannity's over here. I mean, so he kind of had this little motion going. He kept saying, it was great, it was great, it was great. I was a little surprised he didn't go after Lester Holt. Some of his people, not his people, but a lot of conservatives online seemed to be, a lot of pro-Trump people were. But he was very gracious or very, very complimentary of Lester Holt. I thought Lester Holt did a fine job.
It's interesting. He would do that during the primary debates, too. Even after slugging stage, he'd do this kind of locker room friendly guy thing afterward where he'd backslap everybody and congratulate the team. It's almost like he kind of has a need to finish on acceptance and we're all part of a family here.
Well,
it's weird.
It's clear. He does have, I don't know if he's not at home with confrontation or any sort of unpleasant interaction at all, but he does want the person in front of him to like him.
Right.
I mean, whether it's the president of Mexico who he couldn't bring himself to talk about anything sort of contentious with, and then, he has to safely go to Arizona a few hours later into a room full of his supporters to start, talking trash about them. So, you do have a sense that he wants the good night from everyone. It's can you tuck me in?
I think he kind of wants to be in the club. I think he thinks he is kind of in the media celebrity talent club. My joke has been, people say, what should have been done about Trump? And there's also a rap about, you guys are right to rise. You should spend all your money, hitting Trump so you'd elect Ted Cruz or whatever, or Marco Rubio. Is generally the supporter of some other candidate who has brilliant plans for what we should have done. But I do wish I'd been able to take some money and build a time machine and do one of two things. Either go back in time and tell Fred Trump to lighten up on his kid, because I clearly blame him for most of this. Or two, we should have done a talent deal to get him Wheel of Fortune. So he could be on TV, he could perform, he could get the love of strangers and not gunk up politics. Well, we blew that opportunity.
Well, this campaign, the whole Republican primary was Wheel of Fortune, right?
Oh, don't get me started.
Wheel of Fortune. No, it's true. I agree with you. I agree with you completely. I mean, it's a bizarre dynamic with him.
All right, I'm going to take a minute to do a little commerce, and then we'll be right back with Mark Leibovich.
Radio Free GOP.
One of the things I like best about the interviews I do on the podcast is even when I know the person, which normally I do, for years or even decades, I always learn something new. I think life is about learning new things and being open to knowledge. That's why I'm a fanatic for The Great Courses Plus. I knew about this thing for years. They were on my radar screen, and when they came to us to advertise, I was delighted because it's a product I can really tell you I think is worth every dime. So here's how it works. These guys go out and get the best college professors in America, and they videotape some of their most famous lectures, creating these courses that you can now watch on a streaming basis online, either on your mobile device or on your laptop, almost any electronic way you want. You can can listen to them in your car, you can watch them, you can consume it any way you want, and you get to see some of the best lectures by professors who are good performers, good teachers. They make a good presentation, makes the material very interesting. Now, topics include history, politics, science, music, religion, just about anything you could be interested in, you can see an expert talking about it at the Great Courses Plus. I've been watching The Skeptic's Guide to American History. I just watched the section on World War II, which kind of digs through the headline myths we were all taught, which are mostly true, but often miss a lot of the complexity and the facts and what really happened in a very complex thing. If you're any kind of World War II history buff, you'll really enjoy that. The China course is great too, Professor Baum. So, I'm loving this thing, and I want you to try it too. So here's how you can do it. It's pretty simple. You get a free month of unlimited access to all the Great Courses Plus lectures when you sign up. As for my listeners, now think about that. They've got like 600 of these courses online, and you can watch as many as you want for free during that first month. You can give this thing a real tryout. I think you're going to love it as much as I do. All you got to do is go online to start your free month today. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/RFG. One more time, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/RFG. I think you'll really like it. And again, knowledge never stops. So check out what the Great Courses Plus can do for you. Now, a special thanks to my pals in Chicago, our original advertiser, the Private Equity Fundcast, hosted by Jim Milbury and Devin Matthews. These guys are partners in a Chicago-based private equity firm. They're funny, they're smart, they know their business. Devin and Jim have spent the better part of the last 15 years buying and managing mid-market technology companies. The Fundcast draws from all that collective wisdom, all those experiences, to pull back the veil on private equity, much like we try to pull back the veil on politics here on Radio Free GOP. These guys talk about everything you'd want to know, from the seven deadly sins of private equity to the good, the bad, and the ugly of board meetings, which are a huge deal in these companies. So, if you're the founder or owner of a business, if you work in management for a private equity-backed company, or maybe you provide services to private companies as a banker, lawyer, accountant, or like me, frankly, you just like to geek out on private equity and hear the occasional reference to saloon comics like Dom Herrera, then subscribe to the Private Equity Fundcast on iTunes or Google Play. These guys make this topic, which is an important one, really interesting, and I guarantee you, you'll learn something. So one more time, to check them out, go to the Private Equity Fundcast on iTunes or Google Play. Okay, that's the commerce. Thank you to our sponsors. Now, back to our interview with my friend Mark Leibovich.
In this crazy year on Radio Free GOP.
Here's my guess of what will happen, and I have to admit I'm kind of excited about this. I'm a little worried I'm going to be on a plane later and I may miss it.
Mm-hmm.
He will go into Twitter, cable TV call-in, and ultimately rally in safe Republican congressional district therapy now, I think. And we're going to have a hugely transparent look into his head when he gets in front of an adoring throng with a microphone and does his act. But with his take on the debate. And my guess is he'll want to fill that cycle fast, which means it'll be very unfiltered and could be hugely entertaining and just the stark raving madness of it all.
I think you're right. Well, but that's sort of been his strategy the whole time. When there is a problematic news cycle, I mean, you just start another fire and let the firefighters go to that fire.
What's his public schedule today? I haven't looked. Does he have an event somewhere?
I bring you only ignorance. I do not think.
Well, you're a magazine guy. You don't need to have to cover
that. I'm going to step back, and in a few weeks, I'll look back, and I'll see what the schedule is, and I'll give you the 30,000 feet look.
Yeah, I need to look at the big picture here.
No, I don't know. I mean, I know she's going to Raleigh-Durham today. She's doing some rally there, and then some spontaneous little trip to a coffee shop that's been Secret Serviced up the caboose for. I'm going to leave here.
No, and her thing will be huge. There are many things that irritate me about her, but the one thing about the campaign is, in the campaign war of campaign tech and campaign capability, there's no contest.
She has
a campaign. He has a banana republic. But they're going to pull out every moldy old campaign chestnut now. You know, the hall was overflowing. There were so many people there, all bringing their daughters. The fire marshal, because, you know, this has all been scripted.
Oh, the fucking fire marshal.
Yeah, so today is going to be every old moldy campaign trick for momentum
absolutely
is going to be rolled out, and And they're going to get away with all of it.
Absolutely. I'm sure they have, like, you know, they had someone writing up three or four lines overnight. And it's like, well, I mean, they're going to be terrible, too. They'll, like, they'll focus group it over. They'll do the overnight focus group in the middle of Times Square. It was like, oh, well, this was like the throwdown at Hofstra. No, that's not good.
No, but you're right. There will be some clunky line they write for. Well, I think, you know, and then a callback to something he said.
Actually,
you know,
there was this, Jim Rutenberg and I were walking around the spin room afterwards, and there was this
Clinton, I should interrupt another New York Times
Jim Rutenberg,
Brigadier General.
Yeah, another one of my heartland friends from the middle of, like, Midland, right. Michigan, right?
Well, you guys, you unite the Upper East Side and Upper West Side.
Yes, we do.
You
bring we're a very diverse newsroom. Yes, yeah. We are. We have Ashkenazi Jews and Sephardic Jews. We were walking around, and, like, some Clinton hack came up to us. I probably shouldn't name who it was. In fact, I don't even remember the guy's name, actually. He was, like, a donor, but
we're
going to
say Karl Marx for now.
Sounds good to me. But he said, hey, I got it. Here's the headline. He was unhinged at Hofstra. I'm like, great. Right. Do they pay you for that too?
Well,
like,
I heard unhinged five or six times. Clearly, they had their bullet points. I'm like, work the unhinged thing.
Well, the problem is she is so perennially hinged, you know? I mean, she was she was appropriately hinged last night. I think, and that's the thing. She's going to do a very conventional, very effective, day after effective debate day, and it's going to give people like me a headache again, and that's why there are immature, people like me trickle down to the immature electorate, because the immaturity starts with us, Mike.
Well, oh no, absolutely. I think it's a mistake, too, if they do that. Less is more now. If she's doing the forced clunky lines of, well, I think we showed him how to handle a bully. Whatever the horrible.
That's exactly right.
Well, I don't know who won, but I'll tell you this. It's American people won and bullying, demagogic, zero.
And then the planted person in the audience shouting, you go, girl.
Right, right. So, you know, they ought to really back off that stuff, because guess what? You know what the most important debate is? The second one.
You think it's the second one?
Yeah, I always
think. Why not the third? Well, besides, obviously, the Pence-Kane debate. That's going to be the first.
Yeah, that'll be epic in its own way.
Yeah.
We might hear G. Willikers for the first time in a debate.
If this is the Super Bowl, that's the Pro Bowl.
Right. My view is they're all important, but the first debate sets up the narrative of the second one. So we now know.
So he'll do the comeback in the next one.
Well, he's set up for that. Now, that would require getting the dosage right, doing some actual prep, and having a little more depth on the issues, none of which you'll have. So they have the opportunity to really break him in half at the next debate if he fails again. But they ought to be careful about the high-fiving.
Oh, I think they absolutely have to be careful. And I don't think they will be. That's sort of what they've proven. I mean,
and it's therapy for them, because they've been in the dump so long.
Yeah.
I know every donor I joke about, I see Priuses going in the wrong lane in L.A. with people screaming into there, get Spielberg in there. The sponsor shit.
It's
true. Just screaming horrible donors.
Yeah.
So now they have this big, delirious, happy bomb.
Oh, it's good. They won't handle it well.
I mean,
it's actually not that they're going to, like, sabotage themselves, but there is that smug victory lap vibe that they tend to lapse into, and maybe it's a Clinton thing or something, but a sort of successful morning like this just doesn't sit well with them. And
I find Democratic campaign staffs often have a little too much self-regard.
That's good.
The problem is they've won a bunch of presidential elections basically because we're the Washington Generals. You know, we keep throwing the ball to the Globetrotters. We don't compete for a third of the vote. So they win, good for them, and they run pretty deep. I don't want to take it away. They win legitimately, but there's a little bit of, to quote their own St. Ann Richards, of being born on third base and think they hit a triple.
I think in this
election. So there'll be some of that now.
In this election, that is absolutely true. I mean, I think the McCain election, the 08 election was sort of lined up perfectly for Obama. You know, I thought that 2012 was very winnable for, I would say of the three, if Trump loses this, if you look back, I think the Romney one, and if he's listening, I hope he doesn't feel badly about this, but that was the one, most winnable one, I think, given
they
his
had the
skill set,
where
the country was. But anyway, I do think that you're right, though. They don't, I mean, there is this smugness that they got to be, I think, pretty vigilant about, and I don't think they will be.
Yeah, no. I think today could be double Unchained Day, which will be revealing, which is she will finally have had the win that they are desperate for, so they will go over the top, and he will go running for a microphone and spill out the contents. We're going to hear about the secret microphone that was sabotaged, Lester Holt, the conspiracy. It's going to be one of the great, horrible, hilarious train wreck moments of Trump, because he has something to be a bit, I hate to use their word, but a bit unhinged about, and I'll bet he'll go for it.
the Clinton campaign, if I were working for them, and of course the Trump campaign thinks the New York Times is working for them.
And we all know you only are working for them 6 days a week.
That's true.
There's one day you take off.
That's true. And what happens on that day, Mike?
You let the Post take over.
Right.
You throw them a bone.
I think, first of all, she should do some interviews today. She should do some TV interviews today. She should take what her three best answers were last night and just sort of answer every question according to those answers, maybe hone it a little bit. I mean, she'll probably even prepare for that.
Yeah, of course.
I actually thought for the first 20 minutes last night that, wow, Trump actually prepared. I don't know if he did.
But he had one thing that was the most powerful single thing you could say in a debate this year. And he kept bringing every question back to it. Yeah, 30 years, your politics.
Right.
People, we've had it. It's failed. Time for something new. And if I'm anything, I'm something new. And he took it back to that like three times. I was really stunned she didn't have an answer. But
correct.
He was doing some business at the beginning.
He was.
He still had the demeanor problems and everything, but it wasn't nearly as bad.
Yeah, I don't think he even did. I thought he was like, whoa. I thought he was just going to nail the thing.
But then, you know, metabolism, medicine wears off, whatever happens. And
yeah.
I always thought the minute she was just basically competent and got in a few good things and poked him once or twice gently,
yeah.
which was how she did that you inherited the $14 million from your dad,
yeah.
then yeah. He'd be him.
He'd be him. Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I will say in retrospect, now that I have like 12 sleepless hours between now and the debate, it was a fascinating spectacle. I mean, I think the shell shock has sort of worn off, and I don't know if we'll be analyzing this for years, but it was just so amazing to see them together and just sort of like to think, okay, this is actually happening. It actually, in a weird way, felt kind of real for the first time last night because it just felt like such a circus and like...
Well, you had the two personalities in the steel bowl together for a long time, which is always a clarifying thing. I thought it was fascinating, entertaining, and also kind of horribly depressing because out of 318 million people, this is what we came up with. She is the classic politician. She is what people don't like about the system, kind of the forced polling speak,
totally.
The cynicism in the campaigning. I mean, what I don't like about it is the kooky domestic policy, the class warfare, all that stuff. On the other hand, she knows the job. He doesn't. He's just pulling stuff out of thin air. And as his demeanor declined, you could just see how unhinged he is. And, well, right. I think the elites are going to be babbling on for days about, well, it's such a sad thing that we don't conduct these debates in French, the language of world diplomacy.
Wouldn't it be great if they did?
Yeah, no, that believe me, I think there's going to be a lot of whinging about that. But there was a coarseness and just a, how do I say this? His speech, his idiom, his mannerisms on stage really do undercut what we expect a U.S. president to be.
I think that that's right. And I think she is the absolute, you could not draw up a worse caricature of a status quo politician in 2016 than Hillary Clinton. I mean, and she embodies the most headachy stuff about, I wouldn't say machine politics, but just sort of classic Democratic politics, you know, the special interests, the sort of identity politics,
yeah, the money. Theory that they're kind of a corporatist party. There are seven interest groups that represent a lot of people, but through an elite leadership of their own.
Of their own. Yeah,
that's the deal, and protecting the deal is the purpose of the party.
I mean, an election like this, I mean, that is so vulnerable. I mean, this is going
to... Oh, yeah.
That is so vulnerable. And look, he embodies like the worst of kind of cartoonish Republican fat catism, meaning wealth, chauvinism. I mean, everything.
Well, I would say cartoonish both party fat catism, and he's been that guy in each party.
He's been that guy. So I think you start with these two cartoons, right? I think when you get closer to her, you see that she is prepared. She can do the job. When you get closer to him, he still has a really, really high hill to climb that he can actually get anywhere near that job.
Yeah. No, I think the transparent thing last night, if you really reduce it down, she, for all her problems and the fact people are not enthusiastic about her, at least swing voters aren't, she passed the ready for primetime president test, and he abjectly failed it in the second half of the debate.
Yes, but so now we're just, should we just start writing the Trump comes back, he comes roaring headlines now?
That's my next question. So what's the media narrative for October? We're going to come out of this,
so
which is Trump. You know, the polls will get a little better. She'll be up 4 or 5.
Yeah, they'll tighten again.
Yeah, this amazes me, and I want to beg forgiveness from the listeners. They've heard me do this about 11 times, but it's an obsession of mine. The way the rolling average poll, the Real Clear Politics average of what happened last week, as reflected in the, quote, new polling, totally controls press coverage in the debate in this country is amazing.
Yeah.
If I were the General Gang and was running Chinese intelligence, I would pay off media pollsters because I'd be in charge. Yeah.
That's right.
Because it's all the fundamental structure of this election is actually quite clear. He's in a demographic cul-de-sac and he's going to lose and unchanged.
Yeah.
Yet we have the cable machine with the sirens going off. Every poll's the biggest poll. Everything's the Hindenburg crash.
Yeah.
And now the system, the business of covering this thing is set. They have to create some sort of comeback and some false excitement to have drama to sell pet food.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, first of all, I think that dynamic, the cable like freaking out over like the latest poll, has been sort of in place for the last few cycles. Now it's all on Twitter, actually. I would sort of change the media because it happens just even faster within the span of a few scrolls. Can you do that? Can you span in a few scrolls? You know what I mean?
It just, well, you can now. If it's on Radio Free GOP, it's
if
now.
If it's on Radio, it
in
is now
Webster's
official.
Now.
It is in Webster's, exactly. But I think like it happens even quicker. Like, say, next week we'll have, as soon as like Mike Pence like reels off his Tim Kaine, you're no Lloyd Benson line, you know, that'll be like the game changer for next week. I mean, look, I don't want to exaggerate this too much. I think she won the debate. I think it was a good night for her. I think it's going to be it's a close race. It'll tighten. I still think that he's got a bigger hurdle to clear, and he just hasn't cleared it, both numerically and actually performance-wise.
Under the theory of life imitates art, the thing that has to happen now is the Pence gaffe. We're ready for him to blow a chip and have some weird malaprop thing at a speech or something. Maybe he never will, but
yeah,
it's kind of ready for
the
that.
The Pence gaffe. Yeah, I mean, I just think he could have the worst gaffe in the world. No one cares.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
going to
be, if this is the most anticipated presidential debate like in history last night, the vice presidential one, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this will like blow everything.
I think
the
VP one will be boring. I think the gaffe could be on the trail. The two most boring guys in America are both play it safe politicians.
Yeah.
So compared to the main event here, it's like now we're going to bring kitten boxing. I mean, there's just no...
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's going to be a weird sort of... I mean, look, the vice presidential debate's sort of a weird animal anyway. I mean, you know, the Palin-Biden debate was sort of curiously interesting, and then there was the Biden... you know, Ryan, you know, but there was like a little, I don't even know what the narrative would
be. So were you in the middle of the night after the debate thinking, I've got, and you might have done this already, pitch the Trump people, can I be a fly on the wall for the next 48 hours as Trump brilliantly tries to turn everything around?
Yeah, I'm heading right from here to like to my little fly hub.
You're going over the tower?
Yeah, I'm heading over there now. No, I actually hadn't thought about that. What I wanted to do, and I can now give up this little secret because I never followed through on it, but I actually wanted to be in his debate prep sessions with the understanding that I didn't write anything until after the debate. Hey, maybe it happened. Maybe that'll pop tomorrow. I actually think I was there because I don't think there were a lot of debate prep sessions.
No, it was one of those things where he's on a throne. He's like, try court. Yeah, I know that one. Next.
I know that one next.
So what's the next big story? What are you working on?
I'm working on a Hillary story. I'm working on I've got to do like sort of day-to-day stuff. I got to sort of pick and choose. I got to write something off.
But
this
the
debate.
Hillary story, is it October, the final
October,
test?
It's October sometime.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I got to figure it. Here's how it works. I'll give you a little window into the sausage factory. Mark, Hillary story, October, go. So we'll see what I come up with.
Yeah, but you're going to want to find some penetrating something.
You know I always do, right?
Well,
no, I don't know. I think, look, I hope there are people who are reading stuff like this late in the game. It feels like we're in a little bit of a blur, but yeah, hopefully I'll come up with something thoughtful to do.
After this town, the atomic clock of chronicling the slippery pole insect hive of Washington, D.C., is there another book on the way?
I am working on it. Well, working is... I have a book due at the end of next year, 2017, on the NFL.
Oh, my gosh.
It's sort of going to be... Look at the culture. I've been sort of covering the culture of politics and media for a long time. I'm going to try to move that over to the great spectacle of American life that is the National Football League. I did a few cover stories in the last couple of years on NFL figures. Roger Goodell last year, Tom Brady 2 years ago. Actually, Brady last year, Goodell this year. So, of course, you know, in the great media tradition, I have to repurpose a lot of the reporting that I didn't get a chance to use in the first go-round. When I have spare time and I don't have a lot, I'm trying to gather some string on that. So as soon as the campaign is over, hopefully I'll have a chance to get down to work on that.
So a question I always like to ask feature writers and people who have kind of a real style, who else do you like to read?
This is great, actually. We have this like cappuccino machine in the background.
Yeah.
Because, you know, again, if this were 40 years ago, we would be like in a bar and it would be like 7 in the morning. We'd have bourbon between us.
Well, that was our original plan. We were going to go to Johnny's, the great bar on 44th Street, the old boxer owns, at 2 in the morning and do this. You were stuck in Hofstra, and so we decided to do this early morning thing instead, fools that we are. But a few people you read that you...
You know, I love reading Hunter S. Thompson as a political writer. You know, Marjorie Williams.
Great, yeah.
I thought David Foster Wallace had some great stuff.
Simba was the best single McCain piece, I thought.
You know what?
For the atmosphere.
Everyone should read it. I try to read it before every single cycle. And you know, it also features Mike Murphy in a leading
role.
We got to
be friends after that. I knew who he was, and we dumped him on the Italian TV bus. Well, we let him come up for one day, and I was doing some of my shtick then. And so then Simba pops up. And he said, I look like an oversized dwarf. So I thought, I got to straighten this asshole out. So I hunt him down, which is hard. He had like 19 walls, but I got to the publicist. And he invited me to have dinner. And so we became kind of pals. I really enjoyed him. I'm very sad about
his he was a brilliant, demise. Brilliant writer. And, you know.
Great sense of humor, too.
Absolutely.
He was this literary icon, but he'd make the joke about, you know, I'd ask him a pompous question, you know, when we were eating or something. I said, so what's it like? And he goes, a lot of girls. He went right for kind of the guy answer. He was a good man.
The thing about him, I mean, look, he was not a political writer. He would never claim to be a political writer. There are actually, and I won't name names, but there's been a generation of very, very pale sort of Hunter S. Thompson imitators, Richard Ben Kramer imitators. Like, I'm going to be the one that
super
really
pale.
Gets these people. Super pale. And, you know, it's like kind of like the Trump effect, because you can see 5 years down the road, there's going to be a sort of row of littered pale imitators of Donald Trump who think that they can get away with anything, and they're just going to fall.
There'll be dimes. There'll be a Canadian one.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
It's going to be...
They'll be really big in Canada.
The thing is, it's going to be bad imitation of what will turn out to be a losing move.
Right.
So I don't think it has a lot of half-life, though he might still...
I actually think that if he loses, history and the Republican Party will treat him very harshly, very quickly.
No, I agree. I want show trials. I want the old Tin Men movie with the Home Improvement Commission and the ceiling fans haul up these people. I'm even thinking of putting a website together for all the Trump collaborators.
That should be your next podcast. Your next podcast.
Oh, show
right?
trial. That,
show
that,
trial.
Yeah, that's Mur- not a bad
show
idea.
Trial with
that's
Mike
not a
Murphy.
Bad idea.
But actually, to bring this point back to sort of to writing, I do think that, like, pale imitation of some of the greats has been a really bad sort of drag on our industry, but there have been some really good ones too. I mean, I actually, you know, Matt Labash, who I think
is a
friend of yours,
because
he wrote an amazing Mike Murphy profile a few months
ago. He caught me during my nervous breakdown right after Right to Rise.
It was a great piece. So I actually think a lot of good writing has come out of this cycle. It's a great George Saunders piece on the Trump phenomena in the New Yorker a few months ago. So, yeah, I mean, David Vondrelli at Time, did a great Trump, tremendous writer, one of my former colleagues. So there's been a lot. Unfortunately, there's just not a lot of time to read. I'm hoping to, you know, hope the stack next to my bed sort of gets a little smaller after the campaign ends.
What's the rest of your day look like? The sun is coming up over rainy New York.
Yeah, the sun's peeking through.
Cappuccino machine is grinding here. I've got to go do Morning Joe. And
Trump never watches Morning Joe, so you can say whatever you want.
No, he totally does, because he writes like these high school mash notes afterward. They're not my friends, you know.
Yeah, it's, he's too busy not writing CNN and then not tweeting about how he doesn't watch CNN. My day, I mean, I'm going to go from here. I'm going to hopefully get an Uber that will take me out to Westchester. I'm going to go on the Clinton campaign plane, or the press little pen in the Clinton campaign plane. Get some rally down in Raleigh or Durham.
So you're going to cover the self-congratulation tour now?
Yeah.
For a
I
day.
Think so. Yeah, it's going to be great.
Well,
it's
you know, they might give you excesses to skewer,
excesses.
Which would be good, because, you know, that's
what I'm counting.
That's the way at it.
You think, you know? I slept for 2 hours to, like, get out of bed? I mean, it's great to wake up to you in Times Square, Mike.
Oh, well, normally that costs $40.
No, I know.
all right, so.
Wow.
I went there.
That's a great image.
Yeah, I wanted to snap you awake here. All right, so last question. How can people follow you on social media? Do you do any of that stuff? You're on Twitter, right?
I'm on Twitter, yeah. It's just at Mark Leibovich, all one word. I guess I have a Facebook page, but that's all. I don't do, like, Instagram. My daughters don't let me do Instagram or Snapchat or any of that
stuff.
No need to go crazy. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for doing Radio Free GOP.
Anytime, Mike. And I want to come back for the show trials editions afterwards,
It's going to be. I think that could be where we go. Anyway, I'll see you on the trail.
All right, man. Good to be here.
Number one for rumors and fun, it's Resistance Podcasting, Radio Free GOP.
Well, thank you for listening. Thank you to Mark Leibovich. We are now going to move quickly out of New York. The Trumpkin forces are well marshaled here at the glitzy and garish, tacky, and altogether sort of repellent Trump Tower. So we're going to skedaddle over the Hudson River and move to a new secure location. I hear the Orthodoxy police already on our trail. But as always, the only thing more interesting than the first debate is the second one, the rematch. So we'll be covering that in full. We'll be back next week with another broadcast from the Republican resistance with more analysis, more insightful interviews, more insults, more t-shirts, more everything. Until then, thank you for listening. This has been the voice of the Republican resistance, Radio Free GOP. Remember, in the end, victory will be ours.
Radio Free GOP. The resistance sound all can be long.
This has been Radio Free GOP, the voice of the Republican resistance, with your host, Mike Murphy.